I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is cancer physician, researcher, and author Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Siddhartha Mukherjee and Roy Eisenhart.
The way we understand and discuss identity, temperament, gender, and sexual orientation is being profoundly changed by our new knowledge about the human genome. Genetics is also changing our fundamental understanding of disease, from schizophrenia to cancer. New cancer treatments are being developed that address the genetic mutations that cause cancer. The new book, The Gene, An Intimate History, by tonight's guest, Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, tells the history of genetics and reports on new breakthroughs and the ethical questions resulting from gene manipulation. Dr. Mukherjee is the author of The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography, a magnificent Pulitzer Prize-winning book that draws upon his own experience with patients to present a textured portrait of cancer and its 4,000-year-old history. It was adapted into a PBS series of the same name. Dr. Mukherjee is an oncologist specializing in blood cancers, and he's developing a therapy intended to treat certain cancers by modifying the body's immune cells. He's an assistant professor at Columbia and a staff cancer physician at Columbia University Medical Center. Appearing in conversation with Dr. Mukherjee is Roy Eisenhart. Roy is a retired attorney and professor of law, former president of the Oakland Athletics, and former executive director of the California Academy of Sciences. He's also a frequent interviewer for City Arts and Lectures, the Commonwealth Club, and the JCCSF. Please join me in welcoming Siddhartha Mukherjee and Roy Eisenhart to the JCCSF. Thank you.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. Pleasure to be here.
We are glad you're here also. There's no better way to start, I think, in the case of this book than to ask you to do a reading for me, because it is called An Intimate History, and I think that you can give us the segue into that.
Great, thank you so much. The book gets intimate right from the start, so I'm just going to pick up a chapter from the beginning. So just to give you some context, the book begins with mental illness and with two of my uncles consumed by mental illness. One of them is Jogu, the other one's Rajesh. Most importantly, one of my cousins is also diagnosed. So same part of the family, same paternal lineage is also diagnosed. So this is some of that story caught from the middle. Both my father and my grandmother believed that Jogu's and Rajesh's mental illness had been precipitated, even caused perhaps, by the apocalypse of partition. Its political trauma sublimated into their psychic trauma. Partition, they knew, had split apart not just nations but also minds. In Sadat Hasan's Manto's Toba Tek Singh, arguably the best-known story of partition, the hero, a lunatic caught on the border between India and Pakistan, also inhabits a limbo between sanity and insanity. In Jogu and Rajesh's case, my grandmother believed the upheaval and uprooting from East Bengal to Calcutta had unmoored their minds, although in spectacularly opposite ways. Rajesh had arrived in Calcutta in 1946, just as the city was itself losing sanity, its nerves fraying, its love depleted, its patience spent. A steady flow of men and women from East Bengal, those who had sensed the early political convulsions before their neighbors, had already started to fill the low-rises and tenements near the station. My grandmother was part of this hardscrabble crowd. She had rented a three-room flat on Hayat Khan Lane, just a short walk from the station. The rent was 55 rupees a month, about a dollar in today's terms, but a colossal fortune for her family. The rooms piled above each other like roughhousing siblings faced a trash heap, but the flat, albeit minuscule, had windows and a shared roof from which the boys could watch a new city and a new nation being born. Riots were conceived easily on the street corners. In August that year, a particularly ugly conflagration between Hindus and Muslims, later labeled the Great Calcutta Killing, resulted in the slaughtering of 5,000 and left 100,000 evicted from their homes. Rajesh had witnessed those rioting mobs in their tidal spate that summer. Hindus had dragged Muslims out of shops and offices in Lal Bazar and gutted them alive on the streets, while Muslims had reciprocated with equal and opposite ferocity in the Frisch markets near Harrison Road. Rajesh's mental breakdown had followed quickly on the heels of the riots. The city had stabilized and healed, but he had been left permanently scarred. Soon after the August massacres, he was hit by a volley of paranoid hallucinations. He grew increasingly fearful. The evening excursions to the gym became more frequent, and then came the manic convulsions, the spectral fevers, and the sudden cataclysm of his final illness. If Rajesh's madness was the madness of arrival, then Jagu's madness, my grandmother was convinced, was the madness of departure. In his ancestral village near Borishal, Jagu's psyche had somehow been tethered to his friends and family. Running wild in the paddy fields or swimming in the puddles, he could appear as carefree and as playful as almost as any of the kids, almost normal. In Calcutta, like a plant rooted from its natural habitat, he wilted and fell apart. He dropped out of college and parked himself permanently by one of the windows of the flat, looking blankly out at the world. His thoughts began to tangle and his speech became incoherent. As Rajesh's mind was expanding to its brittle extreme, Jagu's contracted silently in his house. While Rajesh wandered the city at night, Jagu confined himself voluntarily by a window. This strange taxonomy of mental illness, Rajesh as a town mouse and Jagu as the country mouse of psychic breakdown, was convenient while it lasted, but it shattered finally when Moni's mind also began to fail. Moni's the cousin. Moni, of course, was not a partition child. He had never been uprooted. He had lived all his life in a secure home in Calcutta. And yet, uncannily, the trajectory of his psyche had begun to recapitulate Jagu's. Visions and voices had started to appear in his adolescence. The need for isolation, the grandiosity of the confabulations, the disorientation, the confusion, these were all reminiscent of his uncle's descent. In his teens, he had come to visit us in Delhi. We were supposed to go to a film together, but he had locked himself in our bathroom upstairs and refused to come out for nearly an hour until my grandmother had ferreted him out. When she had found him inside, he was folded over in a corner, hiding. And I'll read one more sort of follow-up episode. This is just a follow-up. The way this, structurally, the way this book works is, of course, that these very personal interludes are locked into very large discussions about what's going on in the world of genes and genetics. So this is a point of time where we've moved forward several hundred pages, 200 pages, and for the first time, we're discussing the capacity to change heredity. And that has a very important effect on my family, because not because they were thinking of changing heredity scientifically, but the idea that there was something, there was a kernel in them that was somehow flawed, that it had to be washed and cleaned out, becomes an important part of the book. Again, a small little passage, and then we'll go on to the conversation. A memory. It's 1978 or 79, and I'm about 8 or 9 years old. My father has returned from a business trip. His bags are still in the car, and a glass of ice water is sweating on a tray on the dinner table. It is one of those blistering afternoons in Delhi when the ceiling fans seem to slosh heat around the room, making it feel even warmer. Two of our neighbors are waiting for him in the living room. The air seems tense with anxiety, although I cannot discern why. My father enters the living room and the men talk to him for a few minutes. It is, I sense, not a pleasant conversation. Their voices rise and their words sharpen, and I can make out the contours of most of the sentences, even through the concrete walls of the adjacent room where I'm supposed to be doing homework. Jagu, that's the uncle with schizophrenia, has borrowed money from both of them, not large sums, but enough to bring them to our house, demanding repayment. He has told one of the men that he needs the cash for medicines, and the other man that he needs to buy a train ticket. to visit his other brothers. No such trip has been planned, actually. It would be impossible for him to travel alone. You should learn to control him, one of the men says accusingly. My father listens silently, patiently, but I can feel the fiery meniscus of rage rising in him, coating his throat with bile. He walks to the steel closet where we keep the household cash and brings it to the men, making a point of not bothering to count the notes. He can spare a few extra rupees. He should keep the change. You know, my father has, at this point in time, become economically successful. Young immigrant man, two children. But the shame of, and the guilt and the shame of having in his own household something hidden away, the illness hidden away, is still inside his body somehow. By the time the men leave, I knew there'll be a bruising altercation at home. With the instinctual certainty of wild animals that run uphill before tsunamis, our cook has left the kitchen to summon my grandmother. The tension between my father and Jogu has been building, thickening for a while. Jogu's behavior at home has been particularly disruptive in the last few weeks, and this episode seems to have pushed my father beyond some edge. His face is hot with embarrassment. The fragile varnish of class and normalcy that he had struggled so hard to seal is now being cracked open, and the secret life of his family is pouring through the fissures. Now the neighbors know of Jogu's madness, of his confabulations. My father has been shamed in their eyes. He's cheap, mean, hard-hearted, foolish, unable to control his brother, or worse, defiled by a mental illness that runs in his family. He walks into Jogu's room and yanks him bodily off the bed. Jogu wails desolately like a child who is being punished for a transgression that he doesn't understand. My father is livid, glowing with anger, dangerous. He shoves Jogu across the room. It's an inconceivable act of violence for him. He's never lifted a finger at home. My sister runs upstairs to hide, and I watch the scene rise to its ugly crescendo from behind the living room curtains, as if watching a film in slow motion. And then my grandmother emerges from her room, glowering like a she-wolf. She is screaming at my father, doubling down on his violence. Her eyes are alight like coals, her tongue forked with fire. Don't you dare touch him. Get out, she urges Jogu, who retreats quickly behind her. I have never seen her more formidable. Her Bengali furls backwards like a fuse towards its village origins. I can make out some words, thick with accent and idiom, sent out like airborne missiles. Womb, wash, taint. When I piece the sentence together, its poison is remarkable. If you hit him, she says, I will wash my womb with water to clean your taint. I will wash my womb, she says. And my father's frothing with tears now. His head hangs heavily. He says, wash it. Wash it. Clean it. Wash it. Hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that passage segues into the first attempt to make change human genes.
But the power of that narrative is really a lot of the reason why I think this book works so well is your ability to bring personal experience and the narrative of real life experience to bear on what is ultimately an extremely complex and open, many open question scientific area. So did you intentionally use this narrative as a way to bring the reader into your discussion?
I mean, intentionally is a complicated word to ask an author. Because
well, for some reason.
That's right. Some of it is instinctual. I think some of it is necessity. Nothing seems intentional. I think if you, the thing is that if you write intentionally, the work seems intended. And nothing in this book seemed, to me at least, to be intentional. There was a necessity to write it this way. Yeah. There was no other way I could imagine writing this book. I began with a very personal story. That personal story becomes, swirls very quickly into a larger question of what are genes, what's heredity, why are we struck this way with different ways of thinking and being? And that's what the nature of the story is and becomes.
Yeah. One of the early parts of the book actually explores a subject that I found fascinating, and that is our ability to now trace back genetically our history all the way to mitochondrial Eve, I will call it. Explore that area a bit.
It's a fascinating, very beautiful idea. It's in the late half of the book where we talk about genes as signposts or lampposts for human origin. And it's a lovely idea, and it's worth explaining because it tells us a lot about, you know, we're living in a terribly divisive time around race and talking about how we are different from each other and the divisions that it causes. But the idea is quite beautiful. When we reproduce, when we have children, the egg carries all the mitochondria with it. Mitochondria are tiny organelles, little factories for our breathing. This becomes significant in a second. But little factories for our breathing inside cells. Mm-hmm. And the sperm doesn't really carry any mitochondria. The sperm is just a sort of a glorified delivery vehicle for DNA. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do very much.
Yeah.
The egg, on the other hand, carries all the factors that will nurture the embryo, including the mitochondria. Mm-hmm. The egg needs energy and carries all the mitochondria. Now, if you think about that idea, there's something very beautiful about it, which means that all your mitochondria came from your mother. And her mitochondria came from her mother. Mm-hmm. And her mitochondria came from her mother and so forth. So if you look at human lineage, we've inherited mitochondria only maternally mm-hmm. through our past. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it even more, it turns out that over time, if you backtrack these mitochondria, you come upon one right. single human being.
Right.
And that is a common mother. She's not the only woman that lived in her time. There are many, many other women who lived in her time, but she happens to be, and this is not a fiction, she happens yeah. to be the common mother that we all share. Mm-hmm. And we sort of know what she would look like. She looks like someone from the San tribe in Africa. Mm-hmm. But she connects all of us. She is literally our common yeah. ancestral mother. And what's amazing about her is that she didn't live that long ago.
How long?
We don't know, 50,000, 70,000 years ago. Some debate about it, but not very short time in the span of... So I find her idea sort of mesmerizingly beautiful. She's mm-hmm. called Mitochondrial Eve.
Yeah.
Every single person's mitochondria in this room, mm-hmm. although we've diverged because the lineage has spread out, mm-hmm. comes from that same one human being.
Which in a sense, if I were to take that and extend it, speaks to the genetics preaching a great sense of equality across the spectrum, because fundamentally we all derive from mitochondrial
Eve. Absolutely. I mean, this book is a giant plea for non-divisiveness, mm-hmm. a giant plea for tolerance, a giant plea for equality. Mm-hmm. It begins, I mean, it's a plea in every direction because it talks about variation mm-hmm. and human variation. It talks about what it means to be different, how identities are different, how we are different, mm-hmm. And how we're similar, how despite these vast variations in ourselves, we're actually connected at the hip. And that's very much the center of the book. If there's one message that comes out of the book as clear as daylight, that's the single message. And not because of some philosophical reason that we're free, which of course could also be true, mm-hmm. but because it's just the biology connects us.
Yeah.
I say in the book, we're so young we haven't even had time to taste the poisoned apple.
Yeah.
And that's how young we are as a species.
Well, let's take that into some current debate that we have ongoing regarding the difference between the term sex, the difference and gender and gender identity. From a genetic point of view, those are quite clearly explainable, right?
Many of them, and I tackle them in the book. I tackle them head on in the book. And the question that I tackle in the book is, I mean, how do you make genetic sense of these kinds mm-hmm. of ideas? They're very important ideas, you know, raging through our culture right now.
Right.
And what's astonishing to me is that it's raging through our culture in a way that is very superficial. I mean, mm-hmm. what door you use to what room
right.
seems to be an entirely superficial way to discuss these questions.
You You're listening to cancer physician, researcher, and author Siddhartha Mukherjee, whose new book is The Gene, An Intimate History. He's joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So what we understand from genes is very powerful. It's powerful because we're reminded that sexual anatomy, the anatomy of sex, interestingly, is highly governed by genetics. Mm-hmm. And there's very little role for nurture in sexual anatomy and the way we imagine gender anatomy. Mm-hmm. There's really one gene, striking, only one gene that governs it. It's a gene called SRY. It happens to live on the Y chromosome, not unexpectedly. And if you happen to inherit that gene carried by the Y chromosome, then your gender anatomy will be, and for the most part, your gender physiology will be male. And if you don't happen to carry that gene, your gender physiology will be female. Mm-hmm. Gender anatomy and physiology will be female, with little exceptions there, but for the most part, that's true. Now, you could say, well, what about gender identity or gender preference?
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about them, in those two circumstances, absolutely there's a strong role of genes, but here the role of environment and culture becomes more dominant, and the role of genes becomes more complex. There's not one gene, but multiple integrators, instigators, a kind of landscape of genes, and you can inherit variations of that landscape and live inhabit those variations. And those variations then intersect with environment, cultures, choices, etc., to engender gender. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be the case that in 2016, the human mind has got to be capacious enough to accommodate this idea that you can have a strong hierarchical determination of gender anatomy on one hand and a non-hierarchical distributive or lot of variation in identity on the other hand, and both those things could be perfectly true.
Yeah.
You could have, for instance, the SRY gene that specifies the anatomy of gender, and maybe, you know, the receptors for that signal in the brain are different between you and me. Mm-hmm. And therefore we could have, as I said, the anatomy of gender, but the way that we imagine gender in our brains could be very different from each other. Now, that's what's interesting about it. The genes give us the vocabulary to talk about this in a sensible way. But as soon as you leave that world, you start talking about it in a nonsensible way. And then you enter the kind of nonsensical debate, is it real, is it not real, is it identity, is it not identity? I mean, there's a sensible way to talk about it and we should know the language of genes, otherwise we forget how to talk about this in a sensible way.
Well, this raises a basic question about the degree to which our political system, and to a lesser degree our cultural system, incorporates basic science into the analysis of what some people will see as a perverse behavior for the wrong reasons. How do we get a book like this and people like you and communication around these issues so the discussion can be informed?
Well, the first thing is we need the vocabulary. We need to understand what genes are. If you don't understand what they are, and we'll never understand that you can simultaneously have some features governed very autonomously by genes, while you can have some other features in the same organism, same human, that are governed less autonomously by genes, and those are not contradictions. This is just what the nature of genes are and what they do, how they behave. Just that simple idea would enforce or help this whole field so much. It would make it so much more believable.
Talk about the twin studies with respect to the establishment of the genetic basis for a lot of this.
So it's a very powerful study. So the question you could ask yourself, and I'm going to talk about twin studies, and then I'm going to talk about what they mean in a second. The question you can ask yourself is, well, how do you know something is genetic?
Right.
So that's the first question you might ask yourself. Well, there are 1,000 ways to know something is genetic. You could watch it move across families over generations, and usually you can do that when there's one dominant gene or one gene or even a couple, which are, have a very strong effect. So, you know, simple things you can often see moving across generations. But what if they're not that simple? What if they're actually more complicated? And there you can use something very, it's a fascinating, you can use a natural experiment. Mm-hmm. And that natural experiment is identical twins.
Yeah.
And, well, you could say, well, how do you know whether identical twins share behaviors because they're brought up in the same home, in the same environment, whereas this because of their genetics? Well, you can do a twist to that experiment, and this was actually done in Minnesota, a famous study called the MISTRA, Minnesota Identical Twins Research something.
Something beginning.
Minnesota studies, oh yeah, so Minnesota study of twins reared apart, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating idea, and that is that very occasionally in the world, there are identical twins who are separated at birth and given up for adoption. And it's a you can look through adoption records, and you can find such identical twins raised, same genome, raised in slightly different circumstances, or very different circumstances. Mm-hmm. And in the MISTRA study, these people were found, they found them using birth records and so forth, and then brought them together to compare them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, or if you just compare identical twins without being separated apart, but of course this is the most powerful way to study it. If you do that, you can start finding surprising things about identity, about identical twins. So for instance, diffuse aspects of human personality are shared. Mm-hmm. Temperaments are shared. I have this, if you want, I can read from that study. It's surprising things that these people, they share anxieties, they share dreams, diseases, migraine headaches, the time that they want to talk, the jokes that they make. There's the two twins separated at birth who had a habit of rubbing their nose when they were nervous, and they had invented the same word for it. They called it squidging.
But they didn't know each other.
They don't know each other. Yeah. They were brought up in complete, and they were separated long before language had developed. Yeah. Now, of course, some of this is sort of just so story, some of this is coincidence, but you can study it formally. You can you can have formal studies of this, and in fact, of course, personalities are similar, temperaments are similar, etc. But, and here's what's important, this is not from the reared apart study, but just studying identical twins, sexual preference is strikingly concordant, vastly higher than what would be expected from the general population.
Give us the numbers, because they are really dramatic.
So sexual preference, I forget the exact number.
50-odd percent,
that's right. So by 50-odd percent, I mean that if sexual preference for the, this is only studied in males mainly, if the man has a sexual preference for other men, then his twin, identical twin, will also share that preference 50% of the time, which would be several fold higher than the general population. Although, you know, those statistics are always moving around a little bit, but nonetheless, that's what the numbers look like. Now, what does that tell us? It's very important to know what that tells us. It tells us that if you share the same genome, all the 21,000 genes and all the other sequences that go along with the 21,000 genes, if you share all of that in common, then chances are that you will come and converge in these different ways. It's a very surprising fact, very important fact, which means that nature predominates in these kinds of particular choices, temperament and sexual preference and so forth. It's a very dominant phenomenon. What it does not mean, it's very important to discriminate this and distinguish this, and that's why we need to have this vocabulary. What it does not mean is that there's a gay gene. Those two things are simultaneously true, and they don't have to be they're simultaneously true, and they don't have to be disputed against each other. So, in other words, multiple genes could collaborate with each other, and potentially collaborate with the environment or with chance to precipitate or to enable various forms of temperament. Or to enable various forms of sexual preference. The important thing is that if you have a twin, if you have an identical twin, then of course they will share all of these genes together, and of course that will mean that these multiple genes are in both both of these children. But if you have siblings, every time men and women reproduce, their genes are scattered apart. They're mixed in a permutation, a combination. So if you have siblings or if you have a child, the chances that you will transmit that to a child are very low, in fact, because you never transmit the entirety of your genome to your child. It's all, it gets mixed and matched apart. So the idea, and I make this distinction over and over again, that, for instance, sexual preference is highly heritable. That means that we know that genes control a strong aspect of it, mm-hmm. but it's not inheritable.
Mm-hmm.
And that distinction can be made over and over again. And if we could just, again, if we yeah. could understand this discrimination right. between highly heritable but non-inheritable, highly likely to be encoded by genes, but not so likely to be passed on across generations,
mm-hmm.
we would advance our tolerance for people so mm-hmm. much more
mm-hmm.
and advance our understanding of ourselves so much more. There would be more compassion and more vulnerability
yeah.
in ourselves, which I think is so important for so yeah. many things in, yeah. in this life.
As a devil's advocate question, if the identical twins separated at birth have identical genomes, why isn't concordance 100%?
So this is, again, a very important question. Now, in the case of identical twins, first of all, the genomes are not exactly identical. You can get a few mutations here and
right.
there or changes here and there. So that has to be taken into account. But the more important piece is that we know that even identical genomes respond differently to the vagaries of fate.
Yeah.
So, and that's what's it's a very beautiful mm-hmm. idea in a genome, that the genome doesn't spit out stereotypical. It doesn't keep spitting out mechanical responses to its environment. The genome does not. It's a blueprint, but it's an active blueprint.
Right.
If you can have exactly identical genomes, just a simple example of that would be, you know, two identical twins take a walk, one of them falls into a pothole and breaks a leg.
Yeah.
And immediately, obviously, genes in that one body, the genetics of that one body, genes are turned on and turned off to heal the wound.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, overall, these two genomes or these two twins will really yeah. depart from each other.
Yeah.
And they do so because proteins regulate genes. They conduct the genomes. The conductor of one genome will be different from the other because mm-hmm. of different vagaries of chance and fate.
Yeah.
So that's one reason. And some of it is, as I said, some of it is the environment, and some of it is just pure chance.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful experiment, I talk about it, in a very artificial experiment, but it's very important to remember it. You can take two very simple organisms, like worms, and you can make them exactly identical. And you can place them in exactly the same environment, and sure enough, you'll see that there's some differences between these two worms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a microscopic
right.
identical twin experiment. Fascinating. So you could ask yourself, why are they different?
Yeah, yeah.
And you can track what happens is that these protein molecules, which conduct the genome, you know, play the cymbals at the fifth minute,
mm-hmm.
viola at the seventh, etc., etc. These proteins in these two, in this worm experiment, they vary stochastically, sort of by random chance.
Mm-hmm.
And once in a while, when they hit a threshold, they'll start a process off in one animal that won't be the case in the mm-hmm. other animal. It's as if they've sort of gone over the edge, tipped mm-hmm. over an edge, and they sort of ripple just at the base yeah. of the edge. And once they go over the edge in one mm-hmm. animal, it'll yeah. lead that animal to a very different fate
yeah.
and a very different form. And it's such a beautiful idea that,
yeah.
you know, that these vagaries sort of are rippling just below some kind mm-hmm. of threshold surface for us too.
Yeah.
And that if you get tipped over, you could become a different human being.
It's not going to be possible for people to read in this area without encountering the term epigenetics. So maybe we ought to go in a bit and explain how that rides up above what you're talking about.
Yeah, epigenetics, it's a complicated term, but let's it's best to start with a question
yeah.
when you talk about epigenetics. Epigenetics tries to answer the question how epigenesis happens. Epigenesis is the process by which an embryo takes a genome, and then basically all the cells that are in our bodies are created out of that single same genome. So that same genome becomes, on one hand, a neuron, and another hand, a blood cell.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a vast variation
yeah.
in all of this. And there's a huge amount of confusion, which I wanted to clarify in this
mm-hmm.
in this book about this terminology. It also refers, epigenesis also can refer to the idea that the environment also plays a role in genes, such that, again, one cell becomes one thing and another cell becomes something else, or one human becomes one thing and
right.
another human becomes something else. So it incorporates the idea that out of the same genome you can build very different cells, very different organisms, and so forth. So the question is, how does that happen? And the way it happens, again, goes back to this idea that proteins, the genome makes substances, proteins, that conduct the genome. It's a very beautiful
yeah.
central idea. The genome
right.
makes its own conductors.
Right.
And these conductors respond to the environment, they respond to cell interactions, they're called transcription factors, and they conduct the genome in different ways. They turn on certain genes in one cell, they turn off certain genes in other cells, and then they recruit other marks downstream. One of them is a chemical attachment to DNA called methylation. Mm-hmm. Another one changes the structure of
histones
and so forth. And these have been called epigenetic marks or epigenetic signals.
Right.
But really the process is initiated by these conductors.
Mm-hmm.
And their downstream effects, as it were. But the question that we're trying to ask is always the same. The question is, how does this cascade change the way one cell responds to one stimulation and the other cell responds to another stimulation? There's a whole chapter on this in the book. It's quite substantial.
Right. The sequencing of the genome, I guess politically it was announced in 2000, was going to be the great breakthrough in medical care, and it has, in fact, been such. But what I'm interested in thinking about is the effect that our understanding now of the genome has both on diagnosis of disease and on intervention through genetic techniques to try to, I'll not say cure, but to treat disease.
Right, so we've changed so dramatically. The sequence of the human genome has really created a normal template. But now, so that project cost about $3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a prediction years ago that we $1 per, so you know, the human genome has about 3 billion letters.
Yeah.
And it turned out to cost about $1 per letter by magic. But now you can't sequence the whole genome that cheap, you know, cheaply, but you can sequence the active parts of your genome for about $1,000, not $3
billion. Right.
So that's a factor change of obviously several hundred thousand fold, several million fold actually. And that cost is thought to go down, will probably go down to $100 per genome.
Mm-hmm.
Not the whole genome, but the active parts of the genome. So this is one of the most dramatic advances that we've seen in recent years. But that also opens up a kind of Pandora's box of what to do with all of these. So what if you could sequence the genome of your unborn child?
Right.
Or the genome of an egg and decide before you decide to implant that embryo or the egg.
For IVF.
For IVF, for instance. Exactly right. So what that has created is a series of unbelievably important ethical and moral dilemmas that we're trying to answer now. I mean, if you can read the genome in this predictive way, what will happen to our future? How will we imagine ourselves in the future if this is how we read and write? Mm-hmm. And by writing the genome, you can, as you know now, you have techniques to change the sequence of the genome.
Right.
What will we do? How will we, so how does it change being a human being when you know that you're built of units that can be changed potentially at will? I mean, there's again, if we return to this idea, it's a really shocking idea in human history. You know, John Sulston, the one of the people who sequenced the genome, the original genome, said, There's a special moment, there must be a special moment in the lifespan of an organism when it learns to decode its own code.
Yeah.
Right. That's not an average moment in the lifespan of an organism.
Yeah, when you can read your own instructions.
And you can read your own instructions.
Yeah.
There's never been a machine that we've invented so far that can read the manual of its own instructions.
Mm-hmm.
But human beings are progressively, not all there, learning to read and potentially rewrite the manual of instructions. And if we can read it, already our conception of ourselves has changed, but if you can rewrite it, the conception of ourselves has absolutely got to change.
Right. But not going all the way to transgenesis, but simply going into the... Let's take a simple situation of a monogenetic disease such as Tay-Sachs.
Yeah.
Where you could go in, right? Techniques theoretically exist now where you could go in and remove the incorrect gene.
Uh-huh.
So where are we in that area?
Well, so the technology to intervene on the human genome, this is where the book ends. The technology to intervene on the human genome is becoming more and more in our hands every day. Every day we advance towards it. Now, for diseases like Tay-Sachs, you can actually use implantation, pre-implantation diagnosis, mm-hmm. and actually has been used very successfully in the past. So what's to me, what's more concerning is that once you start tampering with the human genome, you can add things to the genome. It's mm-hmm. not, you know, when you do implantation diagnosis, you generally subtract things from the gene pool. Mm. You say, I'm not going to implant this. It's a subtractive technique. Gene editing, the capacity to change the genome, is an additive technique. You can add information back into the human genome. And that's an incredibly important idea that we're facing now.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features cancer physician, researcher, and author Siddhartha Mukherjee, whose new book is The Gene, An Intimate History. He's joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Now, again, remember what this technology is. It's astonishing technology. So imagine the human genome as a, you know, it's written in four alphabets, ACTG. So just four alphabets. And if you really were to write it down in standard font, it would be 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Wow.
Okay, so this entire room would be filled, the walls, with the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right.
Now, for the longest time for human history, we didn't know how to read any of it. So it was inscrutable to us. It was these 66 encyclopedias. We didn't know what it meant. Now, with the Human Genome Project, of course, we learned the entire sequence of all of this material. We know what that page says over there, what that page says over there. All of that's known. That's reading the genome.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean you have meaning. The reading is not meaningful because you don't know what these alphabets mean. And this is one of the great projects that we're trying to use right now is why is there that alphabet over there? And why is it a different alphabet over here? What does it mean? And how does that become you and me? How does it transcend and become you and me? So that's reading. Now, gene editing uses a trick from bacterial cells which allows you to do the following. You can pick out one single volume out of this giant labyrinth of encyclopedias, take one word, erase it, and replace it with a different word, and put it right back.
Kind of like spell check.
Like spell check. Exactly. And that technology is obviously astonishing, which means that you can now, presumably, potentially change the determinants of identity or self, which are encoded in that word. That word could spell the cystic fibrosis gene.
Right.
That word could be anything else. So anyway, so that's what's surprising about it.
You know, we have the luxury, the nice thing about these, we have the luxury of time to go into detail. And one of the traditional arguments against general basic science is, okay, so, you know, what's the practical application? And as I certainly need not explain, we never know what's going to come out of it. That's the whole point of basic science. And the process you're talking about has the acronym CRISPR. Tell quickly how that went from a basic science study about how bacteria fight off virus to the ability for us to edit genes with that precision.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. It's a fascinating story. I tell it in the book. So this whole CRISPR business began years and years ago. You know, bacteria have a tough life. They live on the edge of survival, constantly fighting for survival, and their biggest problem is invading viruses. Viruses invade bacteria, parasitize them, eat them up, gobble them up, break them apart. Nasty, nasty cat and mouse game that's being played out all the time. So bacteria have evolved ways to recognize viruses. And this was known decades ago by a pair of investigators, and I talk about them. They're sort of unsung heroes in all of this. They were called the yogurt guys because they worked on yogurt bacteria, and they were working for a company, and they were trying to find out how do bacteria resist viruses? How do they resist these viruses that come in and invade them? And they figured out that the bacteria recognizes the particular DNA of the virus and cuts it into pieces, or cuts it
At just the right spot.
At just the right spot. Because if you recognize the wrong spot, you'll cut yourself. The bacteria will cut itself, and then it's just like, you know, just like a switchblade. If you don't use it properly, you use it on the wrong person. So years later, Jennifer Doudna and Charpentier, two investigators, started wondering, what if we tweak that system a little bit? And instead of having a bacteria cut up a viral DNA, what if we trick the system so that now you can cut up, remember this encyclopedia of your genome, what if I take that book over there, which has got one sequence, and make the cell pretend or think that it's a virus, or like a virus, that same DNA. And what if I deliver a slash into it? Now remember, a slash is the same, as far as DNA is concerned, as erasing a word. And there already you have the beginnings of the technology.
Right.
You can erase, instead of a bacterium slashing off and erasing the virus, now you're using the same technique to slash and erase or change one of those letters in the 66 volume encyclopedia. That's step one.
Yeah.
And step two is even more powerful. Whenever the genome, remember, the genome is an information conserver. It's dying to conserve information. And so it behaves like it's always trying to get information back. And so if you make a slash over there, the genome will try to copy back information from wherever it has. And if you can now trick it again and force it to copy something incorrectly. It's like overriding something in a word processor.
Yeah.
And therefore, you can add back information. Using that same trick, you can add back information to the genome.
And this doesn't require a gigantic refrigerated building. This is a very simple process.
Striking. I mean, we're using it in the lab virtually every day. Yeah. Virtually every day we're using it in the lab.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly simple. There's still some big questions to be figured out. I mean, does it cut in the wrong places? Does it move in the wrong places? But essentially, it's an incredibly simple technology.
So what is the constraint on using this technique to modify embryos in which there are recognized genetic anomalies?
It's a very important question. So embryos, it's very tough because an embryo is already many cells.
Yeah.
And in order to deliver it properly, you'd have to make sure that every cell in the embryo was changed or modified. So that would be pretty tough. But there's a back door to it. The back door is, you know, there are these things called embryonic stem cells. Mm-hmm. These are cells that you can grow in the lab, and in principle, you can make them into whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And what's nice about them is that you can manipulate them very easily, which you can't do with an embryo. So you could take an embryonic stem cell, you could manipulate it, and you could make sperm and eggs out of it, because after all, embryos make sperm and eggs. So you can make a sperm out of that embryonic stem cell. And now all of a sudden you've got a sperm with the payload, carrying the payload of that genetic change. You've now gone from step by step by step. You've moved from an abstract embryo that you're trying to manipulate into an embryonic stem cell, and from the embryonic stem cell you coax it to become a sperm and egg,
right,
and you have the possibility of making transgenic humans.
Yeah. But what about the step behind it, where you can take and relieve suffering in a potential newborn by using the CRISPR technique by intervening prior to birth? What constraints are we going to form around that technique?
Well, I'd suggest that we concentrate at least on three questions.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is that, you know, when we do genetic intervention, and I really should say this is not true for just CRISPR or Cas, these techniques.
There's other techniques.
There are other techniques as well. But the center is to remember that the guidelines that we've had so far are like a triangle. One edge of the triangle is extraordinary suffering. So we aren't going to use this to change height or color, skin color. That's a strong boundary or a strong guideline. The second one is a thing called penetrance. Let me just explain. By that I mean that the relationship between the gene and its ultimate feature has to be very strong and absolute. So things that fall in the vagaries of chance or have environmental triggers, I think, are very unlikely
right,
because the unintended consequences of those may be something we don't want to go down or entertain. So great penetrance. And the third, perhaps the most important one, is that, you know, all of this has to be done without state mandate. And there has to be something justifiable about it. We should be able to justify why we're intervening on a child with, let's say we find a gene, which we will, that predicts at a very high level, an extremely low-functioning form of autism.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that that falls within that triangle.
Yeah.
Highly penetrant, truly extraordinary suffering. You could choose to carry that child or to implant that child. That would be a decision that you make. But you could also choose not to.
Right.
And I can give you 1,000 examples that fall outside.
Sure. Whatever we may decide are the ethical constraints, apparently the Chinese are already doing techniques like this, right?
So in 2015, the famous Chinese experiment, they tried to modify a human embryo. Now, of course, there were non-viable embryos, so there were some stopgaps. Those would not become human beings.
Yeah.
But they did attempt the modification of a human embryo, and it was partly successful. Mm-hmm. You know, they delivered the CRISPR system, and it was partly successful. And that's what's, you know, that's what scared everyone and said this is a kind of embryological arms race.
Right.
In which everyone's running to try to make changes. And in America, there's strong guidelines, strong moratoriums against doing any of this. So we can stop ourselves. We have stopped ourselves. But there's not, you know, when the Chinese bioethicists were asked, they said, we don't believe. We don't have the same moral instructions.
No, it's really a cultural construct.
They have different cultural constructs.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Very quickly, in preparing for this, obviously, I used the internet. So now I have this problem that every time I go on a website, an ad for genome sequencing comes up. So I'm trying to think of what search I can do to create antibodies against that. But the serious question is people are now being presented online with this opportunity to have their genome sequenced. They'll tell you if you have certain things and blah, 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 turning into a cottage industry. What do you recommend as a physician in this area?
Well, I think genome sequencing is not ready for its sort of prime time in terms of future diagnostics. Genome sequencing is very good to tell you about the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good record of ancestry. If you happen to be interested in your ancestry, and that may be helpful for your not only your particular interest in ancestry, but it might tell you something about disease in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's very bad in terms of predicting what happens in the future.
Yeah.
So that's the problem with genome sequencing. So if you're looking for those kinds of solutions, I think in general right now, I think you'll be shortchanged.
Yeah.
But if you're looking for trying to figure out where you came from, then absolutely possible to do that through genome sequencing.
But, for example, let's say you have a family history of the BRCA2 gene.
Well, you don't need to do a full genome sequencing for that.
Right.
You can just sequence that one particular gene, and you'd have a fascinating and powerful way to think about your future in particular.
Have you thought about having your own genome sequence?
I've thought about it a lot, and I've decided against it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's information there that I'm not sure I want to know,
right.
And also there's information there that I wouldn't know what to do with. I mean, you know. What if it said that I had was in fact carrying one of those genes that increased the risk of schizophrenia by,
4%.
Actually, the real numbers, the highest risk genes are, they would increase your risk by about 20-odd percent, 30% above the normal. So would it change who I am?
No.
Would it change how I behave? Would it change the way would I now want to sequence the genomes of my children? What do you do with the information?
Yeah.
What did you do with, even with a 10, 20% increase in risk, what would you do with the information? So I've decided that I'd rather not know at this stage.
I think it's an important question people to think about.
And perhaps most importantly, this idea that, and we talked a little bit about this, and this may be an interesting place to sort of think about the future. The one idea that I come back into the book is, very many times in the book is when we say there's a gene for something, what do we mean? What does it mean to have a gene for beauty or intelligence?
Mm-hmm.
To me, what it means is that for complex qualities, it's the artificial definitions that allow us to look for genes for things. I'll tell you exactly what I mean. So I'll give you a contrast. People often ask me, is there a gene for intelligence? And the first thing I reply to them, I say, well, okay, let's begin by asking the question, imagine a test that will simultaneously capture Queen Elizabeth, Muhammad Ali, Jennifer Hudson, Snoop Dogg, and Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Okay. Imagine the test in which all of them will score high on that test. That's the first question I ask them. And then I ask them, I say, here's the contrast. Let me give you a contrast. Think about the marathon. The marathon is a defined race. You run a certain number of miles. And because it's so fixed, because the definition is so tightened, I think we will find genes for successful marathon running. Some people might dispute that, but I think we'll find genes for successful marathon running. And I think I suspect this because it turns out that every year, more and more, aside from training, a tiny widget of land in the human in human geography dominates that race.
Right. Kenya.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a coincidence.
No.
I think, of course, some of it is training, some of it is exposure, but really I don't think it's a coincidence. It has to do with the fact that ultimately we're at that level where physiology is being challenged, mm-hmm. and we will get to the place where a certain kind of physiological, anatomical set of characteristics allows you to win that race. So, can we find genes for marathon running? Probably. Now ask yourself the same question. Is intelligence like a marathon?
Mm-hmm.
Are there fixed criteria? Is it 26.4 miles that you have to run? Because sometimes running sideways is better. I prefer not to run at all. So that's my preference.
Right.
But the point here is a deeper point that I'm trying to make, is that the capacity to place things in the genome depends on the narrowness or the breadth of the definition that we're seeking to find in the genome. The genome is like Narcissus reflected. Our capacity to find narrowness or breadth in it, divisiveness or commonality in it, is a decision that you and I make as a cultural arbitration. And if we decide to narrow definitions and tighten them, sure, we will find things. If we say that the only beautiful people in the world are those with blue eyes, then we will find genes for beauty. That idea, if we could push that idea somehow into public realm, we would be a much, much more compassionate series of people.
I cannot think of a better point to thank you for all your work, for your first book, for this book, and for your next book. You've been a great audience, and
thank you so much.
We'll be signing books outside.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was cancer physician, researcher, and author Siddhartha Mukherjee, whose new book is The Gene, An Intimate History. He was joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espele. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.